A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one in the middle of an actual move. He's a few hundred meters from his old place, doing it mostly himself. And the reason he's doing it himself is that the last move cost $4,000. And that was a longer haul. Professional crew. Guys who could stack four boxes around their back and walk downstairs like it was nothing. This time, it's short distance, same boxes, same stairs, but the risk profile is completely different, because now it's Daniel doing the carrying, instead of a crew that does this every day. And he's asking, what do those pros actually know that the rest of us don't? Are the weird circus act carry something you can learn, or is that trade secret stuff? And does the cheap equipment most of us buy for a DIY move actually make injury more likely?
This hits at exactly the right moment. Moving season peaks right now, June, July, August, and with everything costing more, more people are looking at a $4,000 quote and thinking, I'll just do it myself. So they're buying fold-in hand trucks and cheap dollies off the internet, stuff that's really designed for moving luggage or cases of water, and then loading them up with washing machines and stacked Euro boxes. The equipment is flying off shelves, and a lot of it is genuinely dangerous when you push it past what it was engineered for.
Daniel's already learning this the hard way. He bought a platform truck without checking the caster height. Turns out the wheels were too small for an urban move, basically useless on anything rougher than a polished warehouse floor. Then he went and got a proper hand truck with pneumatic tires rated for 200 kilos, and suddenly the same load went from impossible to just a slog. Same weight, same person, different tool, completely different experience. That gap between impossible and doable is where the whole episode lives.
That gap is real, and it's measurable. We're going to look at the actual biomechanics of how professional movers carry four boxes at once without destroying their spines, because it's not what standard safe handling courses teach. We're going to look at the engineering difference between a $40 folding dolly and a $180 professional hand truck, and why that price gap maps directly to injury prevention. And we're going to talk about the psychological dimension, because believing you have the right tool actually changes how you move, and that changes your injury risk.
This episode is about the invisible layer between lift with your legs and actually moving a household without ending up in urgent care. The techniques nobody documents, the equipment engineering nobody explains, and the psychology that makes the whole thing either bearable or brutal.
Let's start with the technique that looked like a circus act, the four-box stair carry, and understand what's actually happening biomechanically. Because when I first saw Daniel describe this, I thought, that sounds like a back injury waiting to happen, but it turns out the opposite is true.
Walk me through it. What's actually going on when a mover stacks four boxes and walks downstairs?
Picture the setup. Bottom box is wedged against the hip. That's the primary anchor point. The mover's forearms slide under the second box, so the weight of two boxes is now distributed between the hip shelf and the forearm support. The third and fourth boxes stack on top, and here's the part that looks insane. The chin comes forward to stabilize the top box. What you're seeing is load distributed across three independent contact points, the hip, both forearms, and the chin as a stabilizer. The spine is in inflection, which is when you're hunched forward and your discs are under maximum compression. The spine is in slight extension, chest up, shoulders back. That's the opposite of what lift with your legs, keep your back straight teaches.
The standard safe handling advice is actually wrong for this specific task.
It's not wrong for what it was designed for. OSHA and IOSH safe handling courses were developed for warehouse and logistics contexts where the dominant task is a single object lift, one box, one package, one pallet. In that scenario, you want a neutral spine. You want the load close to your center of mass and you want to lift with your legs. That's all correct for single object lifts. But a multi-object stair carry is a fundamentally different biomechanical problem. The load isn't a single mass you're lifting, it's a structure you're wearing. The boxes form a rigid column, and the shear forces transfer through your spine differently because the load is distributed across multiple vertebral segments simultaneously.
It's less like lifting a weight, and more like wearing a backpack that happens to be made of boxes.
That's actually a really good way to think about it. A properly loaded backpack transfers weight through the shoulder straps and hip belt to the pelvis, bypassing the lower back almost entirely. The four-box carry does something similar. The hip wedge takes maybe 40% of the load, the forearms take another 30%, and the remaining weight is distributed up through the stacked column with the chin just providing stability, not bearing significant weight. The peak compressive force on any single spinal disc is much lower than if you tried to carry all four boxes in a single stack in front of you.
This is not taught in any standard course.
This is trade-specific knowledge passed down through apprenticeship. You learn it from the guy who's been doing it for 15 years, who learned it from the guy before him. It's not in any manual. It's not in any OSHA guideline. And that creates a real problem for the DIY mover because they're applying warehouse rules. Lift with your legs, neutral spine, one box at a time, to a task that professionals solve with completely different biomechanics. The DIY mover makes 15 trips up and down the stairs with one box at a time, each trip a separate lift with its own injury risk, and by trip 12, their form is degrading from fatigue. The professional makes 4 trips with 4 boxes each, fewer total lifts, less cumulative spinal loading.
The technique that looks more dangerous is actually reducing total exposure.
And this is where the data gets interesting. The Liberty Mutual Manual Materials Handling Tables. These are the industry standard references for calculating safe lift limits. They show that a well-executed team lift with proper communication reduces spinal compression by about 40% compared to a solo lift of the same weight. The communication part is critical. When two people lift together and one person moves slightly faster or at a different angle, the load shifts suddenly, and that sudden shift creates a moment arm the spine can't brace for. It's the unexpected load shift that causes injury, not the total weight.
Which brings us to the harness question. Daniel mentioned harnesses on the market for moving heavy appliances, shoulder straps with hip belts that are supposed to make solo appliance moves safer, and you're telling me the data says otherwise.
The harness paradox. Here's what happens. You strap a washing machine to your back using a shoulder harness with a hip belt. The harness makes you feel secure. It's snug. It's rated for the weight. It looks professional. But what it's actually doing is moving the load's center of mass further away from your spine. The moment arm, that's the horizontal distance between the load and your spine, increases. And spinal compression scales with that moment arm. So even though the harness is distributing the weight across your shoulders and hips, the increased distance from your spine means the compressive force on your lower back can actually be higher than if you and another person just grabbed the appliance directly and carried it between you.
The harness makes the job feel safer, while making it biomechanically worse.
That's exactly the trap. And Liberty Mutual's data backs this up. A team lift with good communication produces about 40% less spinal compression than a solo harness lift of the same appliance. The harness isn't useless. For certain very specific scenarios, like moving an appliance up a narrow staircase where two people physically can't fit side by side, it might be the only option. But as a general solution, it's creating a false sense of security. You feel equipped, so you attempt moves you shouldn't attempt alone, and the biomechanics are actually working against you.
This reminds me of something Daniel mentioned. He said even for someone who's in shape and goes to the gym regularly, moving cumulatively thousands of kilograms of belongings still feels intimidating. And I think what you're describing explains part of why. It's not just the weight. It's that the weight behaves differently than a barbell.
A barbell is designed to be lifted. It's balanced, it has a consistent grip point, the weight is symmetrical, and you're lifting it in a controlled environment with a flat floor and no stairs. A washing machine is asymmetrical, the weight shifts when you tilt it, the grip points are awkward, and you're navigating door frames and stair landings. The gym trains you for a completely different physical task. That's why professional movers don't look like bodybuilders. They look like people who've done 10,000 stair carries. The adaptation is specific to the task.
We've got techniques that look dangerous but reduce injury risk, and equipment that looks safe but increases it. And the DIY mover has no way to know which is which.
That's before we even get to the equipment quality problem, which is where Daniel's platform truck failure comes in. The consumer equipment market is basically designed to sell you something that looks like the professional gear at a quarter of the price, without telling you that the quarter price version will fail catastrophically under loads the professional gear handles routinely.
Let's get into that. What's actually different between the $40 folding dolly and the $180 professional hand truck?
It comes down to three things: materials, bearings, and wheel diameter. And each one directly affects injury risk. Let's start with the folding dolly failure mode. A typical $40 folding hand truck has a hinge point where the toe plate meets the frame. That hinge pin is usually 6 millimeters in diameter, made of mild steel. Mild steel has a yield strength of about 250 megapascals. That's the stress level where it permanently deforms. Under a 100 kilogram load going downstairs, the shear stress at that hinge pin exceeds 200 megapascals. That's within the yield strength, so it holds, but only just. And here's the critical detail: going downstairs isn't a static load. Every step down creates an impact force that's 2 to 3 times the static load. So that hinge pin is seeing stress spikes of 400 to 600 megapascals, well above the yield strength of mild steel, multiple times per stair descent.
It's not a question of if it fails, it's when.
Fatigue failure is almost certain within 50 to 100 stair descents under that kind of loading. The pin doesn't snap on the first use. It develops micro cracks that propagate with each impact, and one day it just shears clean through and your washing machine is suddenly free-falling down a flight of stairs with you attached to it.
The professional dolly doesn't have this problem because it doesn't have a hinge.
A professional hand truck like the Maglin or Gemini uses a welded steel frame, 1.5 inch steel tube, continuous welds, no hinge point to concentrate stress. The wheels are 10-inch pneumatic tires with sealed cartridge bearings. The consumer equivalent, something like the Costco Shifter, uses 1-inch stamped steel, 6-inch solid rubber wheels, and plastic bushings instead of bearings. The load capacity difference tells you everything: 300 kilograms for the Magliner versus 100 kilograms for the Costco. A typical washer and dryer pair is already at 80% of the consumer dolly's rated capacity before you even add the dolly's own weight.
Daniel mentioned that even with the proper pneumatic hand truck, moving 5 stacked Euroboxes was still a real slog. So the right equipment doesn't make it easy, it makes it possible.
That distinction is everything. And it's where the rolling resistance physics comes in. Take a platform truck with 2-inch hard casters carrying 160 kilos of load. That's the truck itself, plus 5 stacked Euroboxes. Rolling resistance on asphalt with hard casters runs about 0.05 times the load. That's 8 kilograms of continuous push force, just to keep it moving on flat ground. Now swap to 6-inch pneumatic tires. The rolling resistance coefficient drops to about 0.02. Same load, same surface, but now you're pushing against 3.2 kilos of resistance instead of 8. That's a 60% reduction.
60% less effort just from changing the wheels.
Just from the wheels. And that's on flat ground. Add a curb cut, a crack in the sidewalk, a door threshold, the hard caster catches, the load shifts, and suddenly you're fighting a dynamic load that's trying to twist out of your hands. The pneumatic tire rolls over the obstacle. The physics is straightforward but completely invisible when you're scrolling through listings online. A platform truck with 2-inch casters looks exactly like one with 6-inch pneumatics in a thumbnail photo.
Daniel walked into this blind. He bought the thing, got it home, loaded it up, and discovered the casters were useless the moment he hit actual street surface.
Which is the consumer equipment trap in a nutshell. The products look like the real thing at a distance, but the engineering choices that make the professional gear safe and usable. Wheel diameter, bearing type, frame material, weld quality. Those are invisible to someone who's never moved a household before. You don't know you need pneumatic tires until you're stuck on a curb with 100 kilos of boxes and your casters have turned into little square pegs.
We've got technique on one side. The undocumented circus carries that actually reduce injury risk, and equipment on the other, where the cheap stuff creates failure pattern you can't see until it's too late. But Daniel also flagged something else. He said knowing you have the right tool changes the whole experience, even if the physical load is the same. That's not just a feeling, is it?
It's not. There's solid research on perceived exertion that backs this up. When people believe they have the right equipment for a physical task, their perceived exertion drops by 30 to 40%, even when the actual physical output is identical. And this isn't just a placebo effect where you feel better but nothing changes. The perception alters your movement patterns. Someone who feels equipped moves more smoothly, with fewer sudden corrections, less jerky adjustments. They're not bracing for failure on every step, so their muscles aren't locked in a constant state of protective tension.
The belief that the tool will work actually makes your body work better.
And the inverse is just as powerful. If you're using a folding dolly you don't quite trust, you're moving differently. You're tense, you're anticipating the failure, you're making micro adjustments that increase the load on your spine. The psychological dimension isn't separate from the injury risk. It's part of the same system.
Which means Daniel's experience. The platform truck that failed, then the pneumatic hand truck that made the same load feel possible. That's not just about the engineering. Part of what changed was that he stopped expecting the equipment to betray him.
That's the through line for everything we're digging into. The techniques, the equipment, the psychology, they're all connected in a way that standard advice completely misses. Lift with your legs is fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't tell you how to stack four boxes so they become a wearable structure. It doesn't tell you that your $40 dolly's hinge pin is a ticking clock. And it definitely doesn't tell you that believing you can do the job safely is itself a safety mechanism. Let's get into the specific mechanics of that four-box carry, because the more I looked at the biomechanics, the more I realized it's almost the inverse of everything we're taught. Standard safe handling says, keep the load close, neutral spine, lift with your legs. The four-box carry has the spine in slight extension, chest up, shoulders back, and the load is stacked vertically in a column that runs from hip to chin.
The spine is actually arched backwards slightly, not straight.
And that changes everything about how compressive forces travel through the vertebrae. When you're in flexion, hunched forward, the front edges of your vertebral discs take disproportionate pressure and the posterior ligaments are stretched under tension. That's the classic injury position. In slight extension, the load is distributed more evenly across the entire disc surface and the facet joints. Those little stabilizing joints at the back of each vertebra actually engage and help share the load.
The hunched over mover, carrying one heavy box in front of them, is in a worse position than the guy with four boxes stacked up his front, looking like he's about to topple backward.
The single box carrier has all the weight cantilevered forward, creating a large moment arm at the lower back. The four-box carrier has the weight distributed vertically across multiple contact points, hip, forearms, chin stabilizer, so no single spinal segment takes the full brunt. The bottom box, wedged against the hip, transfers roughly 40% of the load directly to the pelvis, bypassing the spine entirely. The forearms under the second box engage the latissimus dorsi and the thoracolumbar fascia. That's the broad sheet of connective tissue across the lower back, which spreads the force across a wide area rather than concentrating it.
Because that's the part that looks unhinged when you see it.
The chin isn't bearing weight. It's providing a stability point so the top box doesn't shift. Think of it like a third hand that's just touching, not lifting. The actual vertical load from the top boxes runs down through the column of boxes themselves. They're stacked rigidly, so the weight transfers straight down into the forearm and hip contact points. The chin just prevents the column from pivoting forward.
It's a tripod. Hip, forearms, chin, and the spine is just the central pole everything leans against.
And the reason this isn't in any OSHA course is that OSHA's entire framework assumes single object lifts in controlled environments. Their lifting equation, the NIOSH lifting equation, calculates a recommended weight limit based on horizontal distance from the spine, vertical lift height, and lift frequency. It has no variable for multi-object carries, no way to model distributed load across multiple contact points. It literally cannot evaluate what a four-box stair carry is doing.
Which means if you took an OSHA inspector to a moving job and showed them this technique, they'd flag it as unsafe because their model doesn't have a category for it.
They'd be wrong, but they wouldn't be unreasonable. They'd be applying the best framework they have to a task that framework wasn't built for. This is the gap Daniel's really asking about. Where do you learn this stuff if the official safety infrastructure doesn't teach it? The answer is apprenticeship. Moving companies don't send their crews to safe handling courses. They pair new hires with experienced movers who teach the carries directly, hands-on, over hundreds of repetitions.
The DIY mover is stuck. They can take an OSHA course and learn techniques that are correct for a warehouse but suboptimal, and potentially more injurious for a stair carry with multiple boxes. Or they can watch YouTube, which you've already flagged as mostly influencer content showing unsafe technique.
The YouTube problem is real. Search how to carry boxes upstairs, and you'll find people demonstrating single box carries with a rounded spine, twisting at the waist to navigate landings, holding the box out in front of them. It's a highlight reel of exactly what not to do. The manufacturer training channels, Magliner, Wesco, BIL, those are the ones that show proper load securement, stair climbing technique with the hand truck tilted back to 45 degrees, how to walk the load step by step without letting it get ahead of you on descent.
That 45 degree tilt on a hand truck going downstairs? That's another one of those techniques that looks wrong but is biomechanically right.
Because it keeps the load's center of mass directly over the axle. If you let the hand truck go vertical on stairs, the load shifts forward of the axle, and suddenly you're not controlling it, it's controlling you. The stair climber treads on professional hand trucks are designed specifically for this. They're little rotating belts or triple wheel clusters that let you glide the load down step by step rather than bumping it.
The techniques are one thing, but the equipment is where most DIY movers make their biggest mistake, and it's a mistake the industry is happy to let you make.
The consumer equipment trap. And Daniel walked right into the gentler version of it. He bought a platform truck with casters too small for street use, realized immediately it wasn't going to work, and upgraded. The nastier version is the folding dolly that works fine for the first 10 trips, and then shears its hinge pin on stair 11 with a washing machine on board.
Walk me through the hinge pin failure again with the numbers.
A typical $40 folding hand truck, the hinge pin where the toe plate folds is 6 millimeters in diameter, mild steel, yield strength around 250 megapascals. Put 100 kilos on it and the shear stress at that pin is already above 200 megapascals. That's within the yield strength, so it holds. But going downstairs, every step creates an impact load 2 to 3 times the static weight. Now you're hitting 400 to 600 megapascals, repeatedly, directly into a 6 millimeter pin. Fatigue failure becomes almost certain within 50 to 100 stair descents. The pin develops micro cracks you can't see, they propagate with each impact, and then one day it just shears. The load drops, the frame collapses, and you're mid-staircase with a refrigerator suddenly in freefall.
The professional dolly at 4 times the price. What's different?
A Magliner Gemini uses a 1.5-inch welded steel tube frame. Continuous welds, no hinge point, to concentrate stress. The wheels are 10-inch pneumatic tires with sealed cartridge bearings. The consumer equivalent, something like a Costco shifter, uses 1-inch stamped steel, 6-inch solid rubber wheels, and plastic bushings. The load capacity tells the whole story, 300 kilos for the Magliner, 100 for the Costco. A typical washer is already at 80% of the consumer dolly's rated limit before you even account for the dolly's own weight or the dynamic loading on stairs.
You're operating at the edge of the equipment's design envelope from the first load.
The design envelope was never meant for this in the first place. Folding hand trucks are engineered for luggage, cases of water, the occasional office chair, light, occasional use. The packaging never says, not for repeated 100-kilo stair descents, but the engineering does.
This connects directly to what Daniel was saying about the price gap. The $40 dolly versus the $180 professional hand truck. Consumers look at that and see markup. But it's not markup. It's the difference between stamped steel and welded steel, between plastic bushings and sealed bearings.
Those differences aren't cosmetic. The sealed cartridge bearings on a professional dolly reduce rolling resistance by about 40% compared to the plastic bushings on a cheap dolly, even before you factor in wheel diameter. Add in the wheel difference, 10-inch pneumatics versus 6-inch solid rubber, and you're looking at a completely different machine.
Which brings us to the rolling resistance discovery Daniel stumbled into. You ran the numbers on this.
The physics is surprisingly straightforward and completely invisible when you're shopping. Take a platform truck with 2-inch hard casters, load it up with 160 kilos. That's the truck itself, plus 5 stacked Euro boxes. Rolling resistance on asphalt with hard casters is about 0.05 times the load. That's 8 kilograms of continuous push force just to keep it moving on flat ground. Now swap to 6-inch pneumatic tires. The coefficient drops to about 0.02. Same load, same surface, 3.2 kilos of resistance instead of 8. 60% less effort just from the wheels, and that's flat ground. Hit a crack in the sidewalk, a curb cut, a door threshold. The hard caster catches, the load shifts, and suddenly you're fighting a dynamic load that's trying to twist out of your hands. The pneumatic tire rolls over the obstacle.
Daniel's experience maps perfectly onto this. He didn't know to check caster height. Why would he? He's not a moving equipment engineer. He's a guy trying to move apartments.
Which is the trap. The products are designed to look like the real thing at a distance, but the engineering choices that actually prevent injury, wheel diameter, bearing type, frame material, weld quality, those are invisible to someone who's never done this before. You don't know you need pneumatic tires until you're stuck on a curb with 100 kilos of boxes and your casters have become little square pegs.
That moment, the stuck caster, the sudden load shift, that's where the injury data gets grim. You mentioned OSHA numbers.
Back injuries from moving furniture account for roughly 20% of all manual handling injuries reported to OSHA annually. And the majority of those occur in non-professional contexts. DIY moves, people helping friends, the weekend warrior with a rented truck. The critical factor isn't load weight alone, it's load asymmetry and unexpected load shifts. A box that shifts on a dolly during stair descent creates a sudden moment arm that the spine cannot brace for. Your muscles are engaged for a static hold, and then the load moves. A few inches is all it takes, and the force vector changes faster than your neuromuscular system can respond.
It's not the heaviest box that gets you. It's the box that moves when you didn't expect it to.
That's the mechanism behind most of these injuries. And cheap equipment makes unexpected load shifts dramatically more likely. A folding dolly's hinge introduces play into the system, microscopic movement at the joint that grows over time. A hard caster catches on a surface irregularity and stops dead while your body keeps moving. A plastic bushing binds under load and then releases suddenly. Every one of these failure patterns creates the exact condition, sudden, unexpected load shift, that the injury data says is most dangerous.
The professional gear is engineered specifically to eliminate these failure patterns. Welded frame, no play. Pneumatic tires, no catching. Sealed bearings, no binding.
Which is why professional moving companies have lower injury rates despite handling heavier loads more frequently. They're using equipment that doesn't create surprise failure pattern, and they're using techniques, like the four-box carry, that distribute load in ways the equipment can't.
Daniel also flagged something that I think ties all of this together. He said, knowing you have the right tool changes the whole experience, even when the physical load is the same. You mentioned research on this.
The perceived exertion literature is really striking on this. Studies consistently show that when people believe they have the right equipment, their rating of how hard the work feels drops by 30-40%, even when researchers measure identical physical output. But here's the part that matters for injury prevention. It changes how you move. Someone who trusts their equipment moves more smoothly. Less bracing, fewer sudden corrections, no constant micro-adjustments anticipating failure. Your muscles aren't locked in protective tension, so you're actually less likely to create the kind of unexpected load shift that causes injury.
The psychology isn't separate from the biomechanics. Believing the tool will work makes your body work better, which makes injury less likely. A real effect, not just feeling better while the risk stays the same.
And the inverse is just as powerful. If you're using a folding dolly you don't quite trust, you're moving differently whether you realize it or not. You're tense. You're anticipating the hinge pin shearing. You're making tiny corrections that add up to more spinal loading over a day of moving. The psychological dimension is part of the safety system.
Which brings us to the practical question Daniel's really asking. If you're doing a DIY move, what do you actually need? Not the theory, the shopping list.
And the total investment is about $200 to $250, which is 5-6% of what Daniel paid for professional movers last time. First, a hand truck with pneumatic tires, minimum 6-inch diameter, rated for at least 200 kilograms. This is the one piece of equipment that does the most work. Second, ratcheting tie-down straps, not bungee cords. Bungee cords stretch under load and can snap back. Ratcheting straps lock the load to the frame so it can't shift, and load shift is the injury mechanism we keep coming back to. Third, furniture sliders. These are the little plastic discs you put under heavy furniture legs to slide them across flat surfaces. They're maybe $15 and they turn a three-person lift of a couch across a room into something one person can do. They only work on hard floors, but for lateral moves within an apartment, they eliminate lifts entirely. And fourth, a proper dolly with a welded steel frame, not a folding one. If you're moving appliances or heavy furniture, the welded frame is non-negotiable.
Hand truck with pneumatics, ratcheting straps, furniture sliders, welded dolly. $200 to $250 total. And Daniel already figured out the hand truck part the hard way.
he got there. But a lot of people don't, because the $40 folding dolly is right there at the hardware store entrance, and it looks like it'll do the job. It won't. And the cost of being wrong isn't just buying the better one later, it's the injury that happens when the cheap one fails.
You mentioned one technique worth learning, the stairwalk. What's the actual method?
Keep the load centered over the axle of the hand truck at all times. If your hand truck has stair climber treads, those rotating belt mechanisms or triple wheel clusters on the back, those are designed to glide down steps. You tilt the load back to about 45 degrees and walk it down one step at a time, letting the climber mechanism do the work. The critical rule, never let the load get ahead of you on descent. If the load's center of mass moves forward of the axle, you're no longer controlling it. It's controlling you, and you're about to take a very fast trip down the remaining stairs. If your hand truck doesn't have stair climbers, same principle, but you're bumping it down step by step. Tilt back to 45 degrees, lower one step, reset, lower the next, slow and controlled. The instinct is to go faster on stairs to get it over with, and that's exactly when the load gets ahead of you.
Where does someone actually learn this? Because we've established that standard safe handling courses don't teach it, and most YouTube content is people demonstrating exactly what not to do.
The reliable sources are the manufacturer training channels. Search for Magliner training videos or Wesco Dolly Safety on YouTube. These are produced by the companies that make professional moving equipment. They're OSHA compliant, and they're free. They show load securement, how to strap a load so it can't shift, and proper stair technique. Avoid influencer content. If the video opens with someone saying, "What's up, guys?" and there's a sponsored energy drink in the frame, keep scrolling. Look for content that shows how to secure a load, not just how to lift one.
The psychological hack you mentioned, breaking the move into load units.
This is straight from how professional movers think about a job. They don't look at a house and see a house. They see cube, total cubic volume of belongings, and they break it into trips. Each trip is one unit. You load, you move, you unload. That's one. Then the next one. You don't think about the 30 trips remaining when you're on trip 4. You think about trip 4, track completed units. There's something about marking progress in concrete units that makes the whole thing psychologically manageable in a way that I have to move an entire apartment never will.
It's the difference between running a marathon and running to the next lamppost 26 times.
And the research on goal gradient, the observation that people accelerate their effort as they get closer to a goal, suggests that tracking completed units actually makes each subsequent unit feel easier. You're not just moving boxes. You're watching a number go up, and your brain likes watching numbers go up.
The actionable summary. Spend $200 to $250 on the right equipment. Learn the stairwalk from manufacturer videos. Break the job into trips. And don't trust any piece of gear with a hinge pin. That's the DIY Move Survival Kit.
The one thing I'd add, because we talked about the psychological dimension, is to actually test your equipment with a light load before you commit to the heavy one. Load the hand truck with a few empty boxes. Walk the route once. You're not just checking the equipment. You're building the belief that it works, and that belief is doing real physiological work when you come back with the washing machine.
You've got the gear. You've got the technique. But there's one more thing that might be the most important factor of all, and it's the question Daniel's situation raises about where this all goes next. $4,000 for a professional move is brutal. More people are going to look at that number and decide to do it themselves. Are we going to see consumer equipment that actually rises to meet that demand? Or is the market just going to keep selling $40 hinge pin time bombs?
I think the market bifurcation is going to get worse before it gets better. The pressure is all in the wrong direction. When people are DIYing to save money, they're price sensitive by definition. They see a $40 dolly next to a $180 hand truck, and the price difference screams louder than any engineering specification. The manufacturers know this. The cheap stuff isn't badly engineered by accident. It's engineered to a price point that moves units, and the injury risk is externalized onto the buyer who doesn't know what they don't know.
The market incentive is to keep making the dangerous stuff because that's what people who don't know better will buy.
The people who do know better, the professional moving companies, they're buying from completely different supply chains. Magliner doesn't sell at hardware stores. Wesco doesn't stock the folding dolly aisle. There's a clean split between consumer and professional channels, and the consumer channel has no incentive to educate, because education would mean telling customers why the $40 option might put them in the hospital.
Which means Daniel's experience, buying the wrong thing, learning the hard way, upgrading. That's basically the only available education for most people. Trial and error with a washing machine on the line.
That's what makes me think this episode is actually a case study in something much broader. Moving isn't special. It's just one of those tasks where there's this whole hidden layer of domain-specific knowledge, technique, equipment engineering, psychology, that's completely invisible until you need it. And when you need it, there's no system to teach you. You're expected to figure it out on your own while carrying heavy objects downstairs.
What other everyday tasks have that same structure, where the expertise exists, but there's no bridge between the people who have it and the people who suddenly need it?
I think about this all the time. Basic home electrical work. Anything where professionals have accumulated decades of trade knowledge through apprenticeship, and the rest of us are watching a YouTube video 10 minutes before we start. The gap between what the pros know and what the consumer can access isn't just inconvenient. In some of these domains, it's dangerous, and the equipment market follows the same pattern. There's the stuff the pros use, and there's the stuff on the shelf at the big box store, and they're not the same thing even when they look identical.
Daniel's prompt about moving is really a prompt about all the invisible expertise we're expected to somehow possess the moment we need it.
The podcast is basically 100 episodes of discovering exactly that. Someone sends in a prompt about a thing that seems simple. Moving boxes, buying a dolly, and underneath it there's biomechanics and materials, science, and a whole.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.